Hello and welcome to the Interior Design Business. My name is Jeff Hayward and I'm here with my co-host, Susie Rumbold, past president of the British Institute of Interior Design and creative director of Tessuto Interiors, to look at the great design education debate. Would prospective interior designers be best served in their careers studying for a degree qualification or taking an apprenticeship?
25 years ago, there were only a handful of UK universities where undergraduate students could study interior design. Today, there are 53, offering a total of 117 courses, and this does not include the growing number of private schools who also offer interior design degrees. But are these courses producing the well-rounded students, fully equipped and ready to take their place in industry? Are the courses on offer of a consistently high standard? And is the current degree model a bar to inclusivity? Would apprenticeships be a better way to train new talent in what is essentially a practical discipline? And can the industry absorb the 5,000 plus graduates being churned out of the system every year? Welcome to the Interior Design Business.
To help us untangle these complex issues, we are joined today by three very special guests. Professor Graham Brooker, Head of Programme Interior Design at the Royal College of Art. Leanne Wookie, Director at International Commercial Design Juggernaut, TP Bennett. And Courtney Kiley, Founder and Creative Director of Scene Interiors and instigator of the Interior Design Apprenticeship Scheme. Welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to meet you all.
So before we kick off, could you please give us a brief introduction to yourselves and what you do and your experience? Leanne, do you want to kick us off on that one?
Yeah, sure. So I've been an interior designer for nearly 20 years. I cut my teeth at MMU, then moved out of the city for a couple of years and then came back and have been here ever since, working in a full range from commercial hospitality, bars, restaurants, retail, cut my teeth on schools to start off with, and then went into commercial office spaces and have kind of flitted between all disciplines ever since. Currently, obviously, at TP Bennett, been there for the last 5 years. In a past life, I was an interiors director for another business for 10 years. So got a full rounded experience in not only being in this industry, but seeing it grow and evolve over the last 20 years, as well as seeing the benefits, the pros and cons to students and their abilities as they're coming out of university into the industry.
Amazing. And Courtney, what about you?
So I actually went to uni to study architecture, realised very quickly that I didn't want to be an architect. So went to work as an interior designer and then founded Scene 2.5 years ago. And I think that we believe that interior design goes way beyond aesthetics and is much more about creating spaces that have a positive social impact. And from a personal point of view, I am keen to challenge the status quo and drive change in the industry.
Fantastic. And then Graham.
Hello, I'm Graham Brooker. I'm the Head of Interiors at the Royal College of Art here in London. I was trained as an interior designer, both at degree level and master's level as well, both in Manchester of all places, although I'm from London. I practiced for a number of years and then slowly fell into education, really, and subsequently for the last, almost close to 30 years now, I've been teaching running programs in interiors in various institutions, ranging from Cardiff to Manchester to Brighton to Middlesex, and now here at the RCA for the last 10 years. And when not doing that, my creativity these days is writing books. So I like to write, research, and to publish stuff about this wonderful subject.
Wonderful. So Graham, you are totally responsible for the answer to this question. Why are there so many interior design degree courses out there?
It's a very simple answer and it's a short answer and a very long answer, really. One is the subject is so popular. It's exponentially grown since I was a student. When I was a student, which is quite a long time ago now, there were probably only about 10 programs, I think, in the UK that you could rely on. And it's just become so popular. And I think the short answer really is primarily because of its media profile. So there's a lot of TV programs now that deal with, let's say, the domestic end of the work that we do. And that's great. And I think that, you know, subsequently, people have seen that it's incredibly popular. universities are clever places and they like to make money. So they've seen that they can fill spaces in universities and so on, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. And really, that's the growth. In 2006, when I was actually in Manchester, I started a group called Interior Educators, which effectively represents all of these institutions and programs that you talk about. And that started with 13 in 2006. And now, as you can see, there's plus 50. And what we try to do is we try to talk to them all and to get them to network and to learn from each other and so on and so forth. So it's a really, really popular subject, not just in the UK, but across the world. You know, I go all around the world talking about this subject, and there's a lot of interest. People don't want to do architecture anymore. It's interesting to hear Courtney talk about not wanting to be an architect. Architecture, I would argue, is struggling, and it's not recruiting. It costs a lot of money. Who needs prescription, which is another conversation we can have? And therefore, this offers a built environment subject, which is accessible, open to so many people. And who are we to say no to those guys, you know, and let them try and study this wonderful subject, which, you know, they don't all want to go into practice. Some of them become great lawyers, some become great furniture designers, so on. But for me, to give somebody an education in the art of space, I think can take them in a variety of places.
So if we, sticking with you, Graham, for a minute, if we hark back to those early courses, the 10 original courses that you kind of mentioned, those first schools, what was being taught on those interior design degree courses?
Well, I can tell you that in my experience many moons ago, I was taught to never ask for a tutorial before lunch, after lunch, because my tutors were invariably in the pub. I was taught to, not very much actually, it was a pretty bad undergraduate experience. I had an excellent postgraduate experience, and that's why I went back to do postgraduate, because I felt so bereft of design ideas and skills after my undergraduate. But, you know, I'm being facetious. Effectively, what's happened through fees and through the growth is that teaching and education has become much more professional. You know, none of my colleagues would even dream about going to the pub before a tutorial or anything like that. But back in the day, it was very commonplace to have a negligible experience, partly because we weren't really paying. We weren't really, you know, challenging our tutors to we weren't demanding stuff because we were all getting it for free, which is obviously another conversation point. But effectively, my experience on my undergraduate was I was taught very little. I was taught very little history, theory, philosophy, a bit about planning, virtually nothing about materials. We never touched on professional practice whatsoever, you know, nothing about building regs and so on. So I'd argue that, you know, whilst we're seeing rapid expansion and huge growth, in many respects, it's a good thing. And I think apprenticeships are part of that as well.
So the degree course today is completely different to what it would have been in your day, Graham.
Very, very different. Yeah, really different. And I think a lot better on the whole. I mean, I externally examine in many, many places, have done and still do. And so I get to see stuff right across the country. And yes, of course, there are some places that are maybe, let's say, quality is variable, let's say. That's always going to be the way. But what do we do about that? You know, what we do in interior educators, we get them alongside the really good ones and get them to swap best practice and talk to each other about why they're good, and we do big shows and we have competitions and awards and things, so we get them to see each other. You know, you're not going to be able to just shut these places down, even if you'd want to, so you've got to make them better, so we get them to talk to each other and network and so on. But yeah, very, very different now, very different, and sort of rightly so, I think.
And I was just wondering, sort of, Leanne, because you also studied, you know, a little while ago, are there any other things that you think have changed? I mean, you see students coming through. So, Graham, you touched on things like, you know, the professionalism within teaching now. But are there other things that you think have changed the direction of design education?
I think slowly but surely, universities are seeing the value of real-life experience, which is almost touching on why apprenticeships work so well. This is a difficult one, well, half a difficult one, because Graham was one of my tutors from the beginning to the end. So I'll be very careful what I say. But let's put it this way, the difference I see now, even in 20 years further to what Graham was saying, was even back when I was training, there was still that element of you did it yourself. There was access to things around you, but you had to really be the one driving that. It wasn't driven by the course predominantly. It was something that you needed to be doing. But I think what I learned when I came out of university and went into industry was there was some fundamentals from a joinery point of view, from a detailing point of view, that there was aspects I understood. But I, even working with the likes of MMU, Huddersfield, Sheffield, and Salford, in fact, we went to see their course recently. And it's a case of there is now more onus on the students taking responsibility and also understanding things that are important now. So the change in sustainability. When I was doing my degree, I did a 10,000 word dissertation on sustainability. Would it ever become cutting edge design? Because all there was grey water and photovoltaics. And now I live and breathe that approach and that thought process. Then I now live and breathe in my design. And going back to MMU or going back to universities, you can see it is now predominantly, it's at the forefront. It isn't a nice to have anymore. It is the bones of what is being taught. So I think there's a lot of lessons learned. But I think that has got to be driven by the university themselves, by making that opportunity, getting more exposure to the externals. Obviously, I spend quite a bit of time with MMU. One, obviously, it's close to my heart, but it's also around the corner. But we also deal with Huddersfield, Sheffield, Leeds. We've got within our business, we all have obviously contacts. We've got, there's 400 of us. We've got the London team that all reach out to the different universities there. And it is something that comes back constantly, is the awareness of sustainability, their awareness of what that means, and not in a greenwashing way, like understanding the social value, the ESG approach to them elements now, and what that means. It's not just another acronym, like it really has weight now, where I wouldn't have said even 20 years ago, I don't think we were as forward thinking as some of the degrees are now. But I do still think there's that element that if it doesn't driven by the degree itself, there's no real time understanding. So that knowledge gap is found by like myself, who are out in trying to employ, and you're going in there and going to speak to them. And they responded the way I responded to Graham a long, long time ago, which was, why have you done that? And well, because I like it. But that's not really the response. You need to have a real understanding, a real justification. And that is now becoming more and more prominent. I would say over the last 10 years, I've seen that change where they really understand why they're doing elements, why they're designing the part, you know, understanding building regulations, which based on the Building Safety Act that has now been enforced, which should have happened a long time ago, that responsibility will now be on interiors as well as architects. And it's important that the next version of our workforce really are being taught that at the very early stage, which is university, and technically should be college to a certain extent if you're going into these industries.
Yeah,
that's amazing. So
it sounds as though you think that the changes have really kept pace with the rapid changes and the evolution in our industry, so that the universities really are keeping up to speed with it all.
I think some of them are, but I think Graham makes a valid point. Not all of them are doing that as well as others. So I think some of them are touching on it, but I think the better ones, and you see that by the quality of what comes out and the students that are coming out and their tenacity, their initiative, the way they approach, the way they present themselves, that differs across the board. So I wouldn't say it's 100% there across the board, but you can already see them changes. But it differentiates between university after university.
And Courtney, how would studying for an ID apprenticeship qualification differ from studying for a degree?
So I think the obvious one is that taking part in an apprenticeship means being employed full time or 4 days a week by an employer, whether that's at a studio or even a furniture store that has an in-house design team, versus being in full-time education. An apprentice would study one day a week and get more hands-on experience on the job training, possibly more mentorship because you're there every single day. And I think that there's possibly an argument to say that students that come out of university with a degree, whilst they've got creativity and the knowledge that Leanna's touched on, are they commercially aware enough to be thrown into a project in a studio environment and understand the day-to-day running of how a business and a studio works versus just conceptual creative knowledge.
And Courtney, are there currently any interior design degree level apprenticeships currently in existence in the UK?
So short answer, no. There's currently no degree equivalent interior designer apprenticeship. However, having said that, hopefully by the end of this year, there will be a level 6 degree equivalent apprenticeship that students can take part in once they've finished college education, which is exciting.
That's really exciting. And do you think all ID apprenticeships should be degree level, or is there a place for simpler studies as well?
So when we initially started developing the course, the apprenticeship, it was actually going to be a level four, which is more of a foundation course. And having worked with the Institute for Apprenticeships and the other employers such as Leanne, who are part of the group developing the apprenticeship, we've realised that interior design is such a vast career that we actually couldn't shorten it into a foundation course. And it almost felt like it wouldn't do it justice to just offer a one-year foundation level four, whereas students that are going to have to work really hard to pass an apprenticeship will be so well equipped at the end of it and have so much knowledge in interior design that, you know, they will really have earned a level six qualification.
That's amazing. So do you think, I'm going to throw this open to everyone, do you think that newly graduated interior designers come out fully formed?
No, and I don't think they should be coming out fully formed. It's like learning to drive. You don't learn to drive by doing your lessons. You learn by being in the industry, by being surrounded by different environments, different people, different aspects. I remember, obviously, when I came out of university, I went straight into design in schools. I had no experience in design in schools, completely thrown in the deep end. You learn so much. The first 3 years of my career were probably the forming ones because they were learning how to deal with them difficult situations, learning how to be commercial, how to present to a room, which... listening to me, you would never think I ever had an issue with that. But as a, you know, a junior coming into this industry, you don't really get that much experience. You get your crits, which normally are you going down in flames or something to cling on to. So I think there's got to be a managed expectation there about they're not supposed to come out fully formed, but I do believe that they need to do a bit more of a roundabout and touch on some of these aspects we've been talking about, like Courtney was responding to, about things like their commerciality, their understanding of almost what they're coming into. And I think that should almost probably be fed back from the industry, from ourselves, taking them opportunities to feedback to the universities so that that opportunity can be taken so that they feel more armed when they do come out to a certain extent.
And Graham, are there any key things that you think they're missing? You know, if they're graduating and they're not fully formed, what are those key elements that are not taught, perhaps because they can't be taught or perhaps because there's not enough time to include them?
I think... I think Courtney makes the valid point about the breadth of this industry and the breadth of this discipline. You know, we're looking at guys who will be able to do so many things or at least touched on so many things. And so to be fully formed, I think, is a difficult term because, you know, what are you fully forming somebody for? Who's ever fully formed? You know, so I'm getting on a bit now. God, I wish I was fully formed in anything that I do, but I'm not. And surely that's part of it. Curiosity of education that you want to carry on trying to get formed. So this idea of the fully formed being, I don't think it's ever really going to happen. What I think happens in education, and again, it depends on who you're talking to and which, let's say, aspect of this discipline you want to focus on, because, you know, arguably such a breadth of experience and work that we do from one end of installation art, let's say, to the other end of, let's say, a luxury multi-million pound penthouse here in Kensington, that's a huge fully formed polarity for somebody to get across. So what I think is fundamental in education is to equip students with a critical way of exploring, explaining, supporting their ideas and the way that they would apply them to a whole range of different things. And that might be technical things, that might be ideas things, it might be working with existing buildings things, it might be sustainable things. But my view is that the sweet spot in education is if we can give our students those tools and that confidence to use those tools and apply them to anything from a fire exit to a door schedule to reusing a massive existing building to understanding what the sustainable dimensions or the climate challenges or the carbon counts of their project are, give them the tool to understand that and then can somehow translate that in a creative way that takes this subject and this discipline forward, then that's fully formed in that respect. How they then apply that, and Leanne's spot on, you know, you really learn this stuff on the job. So it's fine for me to spend ages with my guys saying, we're going to do it like this. We'll go through this process. And we go through processes, iteration upon iteration upon iteration to try and make these things stick. But it's only really when they're going to go into a practice or go and start up their own practice or go somewhere across the world to do this stuff, that it, I think the penny really, really drops. So I think if there's fully formed, I think it's when we can give our students the tools and equipment and the confidence to apply their brilliant thinking to a range of different situations. And that for me is the sweet spot in education. And I think the fully formedness comes when you do it a number of times in different environments with somebody shouting at you because it's costing them too much, or by a guy shouting at you because you need to change that rating on that door. And, you know, it's those moments where your skill and your formedness comes into play, I would say.
So Courtney, then, do you think on that basis, given what Graham's just said to us, would apprenticeships actually be better suited to teaching these missing elements?
I think I'm probably slightly biased, but yes, because from my point of view, I think that you can go to university, and probably slightly controversial, but I think university makes you lazy. I think that it puts off getting a job. And if you go into a practice at 18 and thrown in at the deep end, learning through hands-on practical experience, by the time you're 21, when the majority of the population graduate, you've already had 3 years experience in practice, seeing how other senior members of staff work, understanding how complex projects go from concept to completion, versus the majority of the projects that you work on at university being very conceptual.
I agree with Courtney, because I think apprentices are really great, and I don't see it as a versus or an us v them kind of routine, because I think that my view on all of this is I'm an advocate for the subject. So however anybody gets into it, starts working in it and becomes great at it, is brilliant. So the more the merrier. Let's keep getting them all in. And there are different learners and there are different ways of understanding this subject. And some people might be drawn more to a, let's say, a professional or a technical or a different side to it, may even be, you know, through drawing or so. And others might be into the theory, the philosophy, the whatever of it. And I think that we need to create this brilliant ecology of supply where people can choose these routes to go through. So I don't see it as an either or, and I don't see it as a problem. I see it more as how do we get this to work together. I get to see thousands of students each year who apply to me, and we're only masters, so we're already dealing with people who have done degrees. So it's a different ecology, let's say. But I'd love to be able to say to people, do you know what, you need to go and do an apprenticeship to learn about this, or you need to go and spend some time in practice, and so on and so forth. So I think it's all about working together rather than either or versus.
I think just to follow up on that one, I think the beauty from my point of view is very much as Graham was saying then, is that everybody works and learns in very different ways. I think doing a degree for me was interesting in the sense that you learn the process, you understand how to, you know, take something from concept, how do you get a concept, how do you really, and they are the foundations, they are the bones of what you need as the skill base. You build everything else when you come into industry, but there's many of us that have had a conversation of being creative means that majority of the time you're not 100%, you know, you don't learn by reading in a book, or you learn by experience, you learn by doing. I think for me that's why the apprenticeship, when Courtney approached us about this, that appealed on so many levels and is now something that we are looking at. And I know that the other colleagues in my business are looking at from an architecture point of view, because I agree with Graham in the sense that it doesn't matter how you get at the moment. There's only one route in. You do a degree and that's how you're supposed to come out. And if you're lucky enough to get a job where they will teach you on the job, that's a very different one. But an apprenticeship as it is, isn't really formed yet. And I think the beauty for that is that I struggle as an employer now looking for that talent. And if we don't do something the way that the cost of living, this sheer volume and cost and expense in interiors and architecture, that I see as a blended studio in Manchester, I see it from both sides, but at least architects get that time in industry. They get a couple of years, they do their part ones, they do part two, they do their part three, and they are learning on the job. Interiors doesn't have that facility unless you do a sandwich course. So for me, that's why I think the benefit of the apprenticeship is that you are going to be getting more lessons learned and more on-site experience that I genuinely think universities need to get a handle on if they're going to compete, to be able to produce the same level of expertise and them team members or that. Like dev team members or already recruiting virtually. But it's one of them where you want them next, that next wave of talent to come out armed.
It just being a bit controversial for a minute though, one of the issues with the apprenticeship scheme is part of it, if they do one day of academic content a week and 4 days in industry, their outcome is going to be majorly influenced by the quality of the person or the company employing them. So there is potentially a quality control issue vis-a-vis the output of the universities where you have this consistent step-by-step-by-step approach. I think obviously, as the apprenticeship scheme develops, it's going to have to be something that is worked on. Courtney, any thoughts?
I think, Leanne's kind of touched on this when she said, across the board, there are obviously different universities do different things better than others. And the apprenticeship 1 day a week will be provided by a training provider who will standardise that across the board. So similar to universities, certain universities are maybe have a reputation for being slightly better or doing things slightly differently to others. That will be the same from a training provider point of view. But the course will be standardised, and the point of the apprenticeship is that at the end, the apprentice will be a well-rounded individual who could go work for a residential studio working on penthouses or residential projects solely, or they could go and be employed by TP Bennett who work on large-scale complex schemes, or they could be employed by Homebase, for example, who are another employer that are part of the Trailblazer Group, and they have an in-house design team. And so it's supposed to be kind of transferable skills, or well, it has to be transferable to be in an apprenticeship scheme that's approved. So I think that quality control isn't just a might be maybe when you do an apprenticeship. It is absolute. Everything is controlled by a standard that's produced.
That's why I would say to set up a versus apprenticeships versus degrees dichotomy is not the way to go, in my view. That's why we should work together, because I'd argue that your 1 day a week in as an academic experience, the only way that will work is if you get an academic experience to undertake that. Because I think that what we need to see here is a two sort of pronged approach. One might be the argument of doing a degree because you might want to work in practice. You hopefully will at an undergraduate level, but you might also want to become somebody who writes about interiors or a researcher or a furniture designer or all sorts of creative disciplines. And that degree experience might suit you more because it's a bit more rounded. If the apprenticeship is more focused, let's say in professional practice or along those lines, because you're working in professional practice, yet the kind of volume of the academic experience is turned down in that one, working together is the way to formulate it, I would say, because then the academic experience in an apprenticeship would be of good quality. And then vice versa, the professional experience in a degree would also be of good quality. So I think they should dovetail together. The big problem, I think, if I can be controversial, is prescription. That's what we need to be very careful of. And I raise it because all the time I hear it, well, when do we get a prescribed route, a name of professional so-called interior designer or interior architect, decorator, so on and so forth. For me, I think that's the opposite way to do things, because if you look at architecture and you look at prescription, it means nothing. All it means is you can jump through a bunch of hoops over a number of years. I've met great architects, I've met crap architects, I've met great doctors, I've met really bad doctors, and same with lawyers, except prescription means nothing. I think as soon as you prescribe this thing, we will lose so many potentially brilliant people who could come into our discipline and enrich it with a unique take on what it is. And I mean that in terms of all kinds of diversity, all kinds of inclusivity as well. And I think that's really important. So I'd just like to lob that in as a little hand grenade.
Boom!
So Graham, I take it that you've got no objection to universities offering specialist degrees like heritage design or retail design. You're up for everything that's variety.
Yeah, I think for me, the interior is everything from sniffing and scratching a building through to building reuse, through to materiality, the way that people occupy things. It's shops, it's exhibitions, it's museums, it's restaurants, it's bars, it's everything. And the domestic market is that minuscule, I would argue. And therefore, we need to always talk about the interior in its broadest sense. So when my students will work on heritage projects, they'll do the exhibition projects, they'll do sometimes restaurants, food, bar, oh, health, oh, whatever, the whole gamut. And for me, the one of the big key differences between us and our lovely architectural friends is that we always work with existing buildings, and that's really what we do. And we are the specialists in that. Nobody else is taught how to do that. Architects say they are, they're not. They don't do it in architecture school. They regard it as quite often second-class work. It's changing now because they know that the climate challenge is upon us, so they have to. But my view is that one of the key things to differentiate us from all other built environment subjects is the fact that we're always working with existing stuff, repurposing buildings, changing somebody's, I don't know, I'm looking out the window, I can see an old power station that's become an art gallery and so on and so forth. And, you know, that's our bread and butter, I would say, along with materiality and people. So,
brilliant. And then another question probably for Graham. Sorry, this is a bit getting a bit
Graham. Graham, stop hogging it all. God damn it.
Many students today are finding that just doing an undergraduate degree isn't enough, and then they go on and jump into a master's. And obviously here you are, and you're head of the master's program at the Royal College of the Arts. Does doing a master's in interior design help to make these students more employable?
Yeah, I think, again, it's not the thing that we set out to do in many respects, but ultimately they become super employable, because what the master's is, I think, is your undergraduate degree, in my view, should be almost like the building blocks of everything. So you need to learn skills. You need to learn a bit about the idea of the interior, maybe some history, maybe a bit of theory. You need to understand about what it takes to run out of a building when it's on fire, maybe draw a plan and section and so on and so forth. You know, it's all those fundamental things that you need as an undergraduate. Then you might go off and test that out in a practice context, let's say. The master's is really, sometimes, I think most of the time, most of my students come to us because they've worked for a number of years, myself included. This is how I did my master's. I'd worked for a number of years and I got so bored with work because, and this is my problem, that I was just not really feeling very intellectually challenged or stimulated by the work that I was doing. I started getting really grumpy with clients when they didn't sort of get an idea and stuff like that. So I thought, what can I do? So many of my students are the same. They've worked, they've done their undergraduate degree, and then they think there's more to life than this. And so they normally do a master's. And what it does is it retunes their antennae. It regrades their brain in a way where they can challenge and experiment. They buy themselves a year and they can really explore what they want their practice, their work to become. And because we are who we are, reputationally, it's very good for them to come out of here with a master's from the Royal College of Art, because it opens doors and so on and so forth. That's great. But the real proof in the pudding, I think, is that my guys, they will do stuff that's really pushing the boundaries of what the interior is, what it might be, how it might become. And therefore, they are highly employable because they go into practices that really want. I mean, I have five students of my little team last year who are now working at Foster's. And they're running Foster's ragged by telling them actually what they need to do with their practice and how they need to approach projects. And that's how it should be. We're not here just to feed industry, because that will kill industry and it will kill us, because nobody will challenge it. So we like to think that we're making people who will be super employable, but they won't just do what they're told. They'll challenge your way of thinking, what practice is. And I really hope that continues, because otherwise this wonderful discipline will wither on the vine if nobody's challenging you. If you just keep doing the same thing, if it's just door schedules week in, week out, then we ain't going to develop this subject. We're not going to challenge it, you know? So that's what we set out to do. And yeah, my guys become super employable. They're all over the world now. And I've been teaching long enough, as Leanne will attest to this. You know, people I've taught in the past, Leanne included, have become brilliant practitioners, brilliant designers, brilliant thinkers. And for me, it's lovely. You know, I keep bumping into people that I've taught and they're like doing this and doing that all around the world. It's lovely. I like to think that, you know, it's my way of manipulating the planet. I'm filling it with interior designers.
I think we're going to call them Graham Brooker's creative disruptors.
Yeah, I mean, I love the fact we've got an example of Graham Brooker's theory here on the podcast. So Leanne, do you want to add anything to that?
I think I was the main disruptor on our course. I think me and Graham argued more than most. I think,
and I loved every minute of it.
I know, I'm sure you did. I'm sure you're like, Jesus, get her out of here. I think it's important. I think there's some valid points in there, in the sense of the whole idea is to challenge. So it isn't about us just replicating the same. It's about challenging and making that creative approach. And I mean, we call them disruptors, but I think it's just challenging the status quo. Like, you know, for a long time, we've been challenging, even in workplace, for instance, challenging who decided Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 was a working day in an office. It doesn't comply in anywhere else. And yet we've had lockdown. And it's funny, we talked about before saying about how things change, like, you know, 2008, 2009, you know, we had the recession, and that changed the way we had to think. We all had to pivot. We had to evolve. Different industries fell out of that. And now when you're designing, as we do for us, it's human-centric design, no matter what format it comes in, whether you're designing a cart that goes outside to, you know, a million square foot office space. As a designer, our role is to understand the problem, understand the boundaries and the restrictions, I'd say in one set, the rules and the regulations. And then your job as a designer, as you evolve, is to challenge them and to almost break them. And once you understand the fundamentals, that's where we can always come back at that. I think, as Graham said, you've got quite a lot of students that a master's is an interesting one, because you come back into a master's as a very different person, because you've been in industry. You've got a lot of things that you want to challenge, and you're now looking for that step and that understanding. And it's, like you said, it's a year out. I think interiors and architecture will always be, for me, a passion. I was very much like Courtney, as I think most interiors. I always wanted to do architecture. When I got the opportunity to switch once I'd done my degree, the opportunity of having control of the interior was something that was always fundamental. But I've always had that friction with architecture about the sense of you get given an environment and then you have to deal with that. So working for TP Bennett, my approach has been that we are a blended studio. So our interior designers know how to design architecturally and technically, and vice versa. And we design and approach every project together, whether we are doing an architectural building or a master plan. Even a master plan, the interiors team are part of it, because it is about that experience. I think we, as an industry, have so much to be able to provide. And because we are talking about, we're considering everything from that usability, our teams are now doing really, really well in that instance to be able to show that range. And I think that's what we need to be seeing more of. You're right, we do design with the building that's existing. I think adaptive reuse is an incredible approach, and it's now finally a word. I can't stand refurbishment or retrofit. It's adaptive reuse. It's genuinely taking a building, understanding it from its bones, whatever its history is, design it from the inside out. And then if we get the opportunity to architecturally intervene, then so be it. So I think our industry's come a long way, and it's finally starting to get the credibility that changing rooms nearly ripped apart. And obviously there's new elements on TV, and I'm not plugging any of them because I choose not to watch them. However, if it gets people interested in our industry, even that spark, then it's doing the right things, because we are creating that environment for the future, and we are very much important in that aspect. So in any way, shape, we can get people into our industry, let's do it.
How inclusive do you think interior design is currently? And what are the barriers to entry for someone wanting to become an interior designer?
I think that the industry has made strides towards being way more inclusive recently, but I think that there are still barriers related to people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, race, gender, and I think there's a statistic that I've learned off by heart whilst working on the apprenticeship, that those from lower socioeconomic backgrounds make up just 12% of the workforce in creative industries, despite being 44% of the UK population. And you know, that is creative industries as a whole, not just interior design. You know, obvious barriers are cost of higher education, maybe limited access to professional networks, and just lack of diversity in the industry, and the need for practical experience, which employers want from employees, but employees are finding harder and harder to get that experience before kind of having worked anywhere or done a degree or an apprenticeship or what have you.
And on that basis, I think I know the answer to this one, but Courtney, do you think these students would be better served by starting an interior design apprenticeship?
I think that, you know, as Graham has touched on, a degree and an apprenticeship offer kind of just different entries for different people. So from my point of view, an apprenticeship provides a platform for the industry to be much more inclusive, because there's not that cost of getting in debt that comes with getting a degree. And, you know, there's then that practical experience which offers the professional network. But that's, you know, not to say that people who have access to a degree and want to go down a higher education route, there's anything against that. But yeah, I think it definitely will contribute towards making interior design a much more inclusive industry.
Graham, you must have seen life pre-student loans as well as post-student loans. So do you see the influence of that affecting the intake?
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, I myself am from a lower socioeconomic background, and I probably today would never have got to university because I'm from a working class background, first to go to university, et cetera, et cetera. And I would have balked at the money that you have to pay now. So I think that that's a problem, really. And yes, I work in a very vulnerable institution that charges a fortune for people to undertake a master's. So I'm fully aware of that. And so I think that that is a huge problem. And that's a big problem that the next government will have to solve, really, because education is currently tanking. Universities are tanking because of the money situation and the loan situation. And yet to see a very creative solution. Maybe if, you know, somebody in government was an interior designer, they might come up with a creative solution for some of this stuff, really. But the fee stuff is really a big, big subject. The notion of diversity and inclusivity in the discipline is also a massive, massive subject. I'm a trustee of United in Design, which is an apprenticeship scheme. I've been running the apprenticeship scheme with them for 3 years. This is why I'm a fan of apprentices. And we've been working really hard to get quite a lot now. I think we're on about 25, maybe 30 apprentices have come through the scheme from all kinds of different backgrounds, heritages. All kinds of diverse students into the industry to do a year-long apprenticeship, fully paid, and they're doing brilliantly. So fully recognize it and realize that I think we are making headway, but not enough, and it needs to speed up and we need to open up more.
I think there's a couple of steps that could be done that we don't do. I think our industry, I think not just our industry is in a wider term of construction, project management, of MEP, of there's so many things that you don't know about these. I didn't know that interior design was a job. Before I came to do this, I was literally down the road of doing A-levels in biology and chemistry and was going to be an equine nurse, specialised in horses. Like, I was down that route. And it was only because my husband was doing a foundation that I turned up for the day. They were developing film, which for anyone who doesn't know what film is, it's when it came in a canister and you had to take it out and you only got 35 shots. And for me, that was, I was just like, I was taken away and blown away and spoke to his tutor that day. And I was like, I had no idea that you could get a job in the creative industry. Like, I did an A-level in art just to keep my hand in. But off the back of that, I then at 19 decided to go back and restart my entire thought process on what my career was going to be and came into this industry at full pelt. I barged my way through a 2-year BTEC and did it in a year and 2 months and then came straight into MMU. No disrespect, but I could not get into industry quick enough. I was like just trying to get all the information I needed to get me where I need to be so I could get into this industry. And now nearly 20 years down the line, I remember my first year out thinking, oh my God, what the hell am I doing? So I think it's one of them. It's quite an interesting take on kind of where we're going to go in the future and how we really make sure that we are making opportunities. I guess back in my day, it was bursaries. Bursaries were something that helped very much like everybody else. And as Graham was saying, you know, I'm the first one, the only one in my family to go and do a degree. My mother was a nurse. She did an apprenticeship to get into her job. So it's something that, you know, coming to uni was a big deal. And I don't think I would have been able to afford it based on the fees that we've got right now. And we do really need to, if we're going to keep developing these our workforce and the creativity and the environments, and we want to start seeing exciting change, we do need to really invest in that. But we do need to try and get back to how is that education piece done? Not just college. We're talking like primary school. You know, girls need to know they can come into construction. Working with women in property for the last 3 years as a judge for that has been, for me, absolutely mind-blowing in the sense that the sheer talent that is coming through is on another level. The things that they are doing, their environment, their exposure, but the knowledge they come with and the kind of tenacity to be in their field. And they are doing that work. They're going back to colleges, going back to school, going to primary school and telling a diverse range and age group that they can drive a digger, they can go into construction, that they can do PM in, they can do electrical engineering. Like, there's no bars on any of that. And I think that's where we need to be pushing back. University is a very different thing. You are already established. You've been curated. You've been molded to a certain extent of what your job or where you should be going based on not being told any of that information in our younger, more formative years. So I think that's where we should be going, if I'm completely honest. And then it means that people can find their route through university, but they come armed because they've been learning that element very early doors and knowing they could.
Susie talked in her introduction about there being 5,000 plus graduates being churned out of the system every year. Do you think there are enough opportunities for them in interior design as a result? Or do you think employers need to change to recognise that degree level and even apprenticeships, they're sort of producing different types of people now?
I think it's quite interesting to see that there's that many in the industry. And even since 2008, 2009, when we saw a lot of people come out into our industry and then they were stifled because the jobs were being fought over. So what a junior would normally go for, a midway, a senior, and almost sometimes, you know, AD level were coming for the same job. It put everybody in a difficult spot. And then we had a window where we couldn't find the talent. We couldn't find juniors that, because they'd all gone into something different because they'd lost that first year. If we hadn't tried to grab them at that stage, they'd either walked away from the industry altogether because there wasn't that opportunity, or they'd gone into something completely different. So I think it's a valid point. 5,000, to know that there's that many kicking out, you'd want to make sure that there's that. And the amount of industry and interiors and different elements that we've got, you know, as a designer, they can go into are out there. But I do think there's probably, it sounds like there's a shortage, because what are all them people? If I knew there was 5,000 to be able to get hold of, I'd be snapping them up left, right, centre. But they don't seem to get that further through. So we end up with this gap of like middle to senior level people who've got industry experience between 3 and 6 years. Are they not here because they've not been able to take them opportunities? Or as practices, we're not taking the time to really nurture that generation, that next stage, that important part of bringing them in at junior level to really bring them on. Maybe it is. Maybe we should be doing more.
I think it makes a healthy discipline, because we have, let's say, 5,000 people flooding out of these venerable institutions looking for work and so on and so forth. The best quality students will always get work, in my view. They'll always be picked up and they will have numerous offers and so on and so forth. And that's the way it kind of works. The greatest students, the ones who are the best thinkers, are going to get hoovered up and hopefully have really long, really rich careers. Some of those who maybe aren't so good may still find work in the industry and so on and so forth. And those who might still be good might still want to go into a completely different industries. And I suppose the bottom line for me is that if we have a world that's populated by more and more people that have been through an interior design education, even though they might become lawyers or vets or politicians or nurses, for me, that's a good thing, because they will have learned about space. They will be thinking like an interior designer with regards to certain ways of thinking about politics or veterinary surgery or whatever it is. I don't think that's a bad thing. And, you know, I don't think you can guarantee that a degree experience will get anybody a job. Arguably, you could say that about an apprenticeship, and that's where it might become very useful, because you are working in a practice. But not everybody wants to take an interior design degree because they necessarily want a job in it. I have many students, when I was teaching undergraduate, maybe it was me who was putting them off, but, you know, some of them by the end of it would just be like, I don't want anything to do with this anymore, you know, and that's fair enough. Leanne's laughing.
I just said no comment.
Yeah, no comment from Leanne.
Look at her now. However we locked horns, here you are now.
I think I've always been this, unfortunately, this bargy, always been this tenacious. But I think you're right in the sense that, you know, there will be that range, but I still think there's an opportunity, and it's probably something that we should be doing in the industry to be able to allow, because you don't know, a student, you know, a university student could come out with a lower grade within that discipline, but actually becomes one of the best students you have that then goes on to be, you know, a director. It could be anything. I mean, I got a very mediocre degree. It didn't change or stop me from progressing in my career. I pushed hard. I mean, you're creative and you've got a passion for what you do, that's the bit you can't push, that's the bit you can't make. You can teach everything else, you can teach all the skills, you can teach all the regulations. Having the passion for what we do, that kind of like get up and go, that initiative, I think is the most important part, and that's where people really shine. Even students we've taken on, we've got a second year student here, B, and we've had her for a year. She's been incredible. The leaps and bounds we've seen her go on to be. You know, she goes back to university this year to finish her degree, and you can see her look at it and she's like, I don't know if I want to go back and do my degree. And I'm like, well, you're a fully grown adult, so you can make your own decisions. However, you've invested that amount of time in doing your degree that in my personal opinion, why would you give that up at this stage? You might as well complete that. We're always going to be here. The experience and the knowledge that we hope that we've shared and that you've learned based on her taking the initiative to push, that's worth its weight in gold. And I think more and more degree courses should be doing that. And I think that's where the apprenticeship will earn its keep, because you're getting that one-to-one, you're getting that experience. You're in the room when things go wrong and how they're dealt with. So I think there's a balance with all.
Do you agree with that, Courtney? I bet you do.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it goes back to Graham saying that, you know, there's lots of students that get to the end of a degree and don't actually want anything to do with interior design. I think that there is a battle here where, you know, having gone into schools and given careers talks to as low young as year 9 and 10, so kind of 13, 14, these students don't have a clue what interior designers are or do. And I think it's about informing students, you know, younger, that these creative careers exist, so that when they do come to make the decision of what degree or apprenticeship or career route they want to go down, they're much more well informed, so that they're not getting to the end of a degree and then thinking, oh, this actually wasn't for me. And, you know, I think that happens across the board on most degrees probably, but, you know, there's just not that awareness in school about creative industries as a whole, I don't think.
So apprentices probably are going to be unlikely to move away from home to live the university life, which university life for most people is a very formative experience. If they've not had that university experience, does that put them at a disadvantage later in life?
It didn't do me any harm. I was working all the way through my degree. I lived and drove into Manchester every day. Sometimes it would take me 45 minutes. Sometimes it would take me 3 hours. And I did it all the way through my degree. I think the people that you meet are friends for life, and they help with your network as you get further on in your career, because you come through the ranks together. But I've obviously only got a personal approach to that. But you do make friends for life, and there are elements of it that I still had without having that university life, if that makes sense, which I think in some instances you could still get from a working environment.
Yeah, Courtney, what do you think on that one? Do you think people get the same breadth of experience if they don't spend 3 years in a university?
I think that they're missing out on a traditional university experience where you're living in halls with people that you don't know. But I think that social and personal development can still very much occur in a work environment. And employers now, many offer support networks, community building activities for apprentices, younger members of staff and the whole workforce. So, you know, they're gaining industry connections early on, but also still having that social interaction with people that you get at university. And I've got a slightly personal approach that's similar to Leanne's, where I commuted to MMU as well. And, you know, I don't think it did me any harm. I would not have wanted to have lived at university. So, but that's just my opinion.
I think the notion of the lovely formative sort of experience of university life is something of the past, really. My generation experienced it, and I did so. And that was because I was part of an educational experience at my undergraduate level anyway that was more or less free. I was given a grant. I didn't have to pay fees. And so the generations of today, that notion of escaping from home and finding your own feet and so on and so forth is a lovely idea. But we're unfortunately in the sort of age of massive fees, the industrialization of higher education, the big business of higher education and fee-paying students and so on and so forth. So it's a serious business, and it's a serious business where you can't afford to rent, let's say. You can't take a risk on lumping yourself in with a bunch of three other people in a house that you don't know what they're going to be like and so on and so forth. The whole thing of mental health issues amongst students now is incredible, and that's partly related to the stresses of fees, cost of living, even contemplating home ownership without between 50 and 100 grand's worth of debt when you finish an undergraduate experience these days is pie in the sky. And so I think we've got to change our mindset. There is no formative experience in that front anymore. And you know, as Leanne says, I remember, Leanne, that you used to commute in, because trying to sort of organize tutorials in a way where I was aware of where they were coming from and so on. And I think we always need to be aware that just people aren't really having that formative experience. They're working hard. It's embarrassing, really. If we have a party of some kind to celebrate a review or something, it's only the staff who are getting drunk on the cheap lager. All the students are like, no, I've got to go and work now, or I need to go and do that shift, or I need to drive home, or so on and so forth. And that's the reality, really. And rightly or wrongly, I think that that's our student body of today. And I respect that, and I appreciate the contexts in which they are operating. So I do hope people do still have formative experiences. And I love the idea, as Leanne says, that people still make great friendships and networks and stuff that supports them forever and a day, because that's brilliant. That's part of what it should be. But the formative experience is maybe not really a thing anymore.
Maybe just not as high on the level as it used to be. But also I think COVID put a big stump on that. I think that's probably what reframed everybody's approach, that I can do this remote, but then they realise that that experience has disappeared and it has had a big impact. And I think it's that social and mental element that we were talking about as well, that at least during an apprenticeship, you're part of a unit. When the university, if you didn't know the people during COVID, a lot of the feedback we're getting from the students coming through is that they didn't really make friends because they didn't get to see that many people. You see a couple of people on screen. So I think COVID's had a bit of an impact on that. And it'd be interesting to actually speak back to the universities and to the students to see how they feel, what their priority list is now compared to what ours were 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. But yeah, I think there's a balance to be had there. But I think, like you said, there's quite a lot of the next generation. They don't drink like we used to do. They're not interested in them things as much. But don't get me wrong, there's definitely a high percentage. I'm under no illusion. But
I was going to say, I wish I was one of them.
Look, well, we all do, believe me. We all wish we had that element in us. But when I meet, you know, even our younger generation, they're not really that interested. And it's been really good for us because we try and put on a range of things that as groups that we do and talk and activities rather than we'll see everybody at the pub. Again, it's that kind of catering for all. Not everybody wants to give up their personal time to go out drinking, knowing it'll ruin them for the next day. But actually, the idea of doing something together where we actually have a good laugh and we can talk about that for the next couple of days or next week, or that gets brought up at a Christmas quiz, it's that bonding. I think the biggest element is, as long as them elements can be, whether it's a degree or whether it's an apprenticeship or it's learning on the job or learning through an open university, whichever way it is, you having that contact is probably the biggest lesson we've learned, is that we are social creatures and we need each other. So we should be making sure that that happens in every aspect.
I think it's one thing that COVID has really taught all educators, and that is that online teaching of design is not possible. You can instruct. I could do a lecture or I can do a meeting where I'm imparting information, but it's purely transactional via online. And big, big problem and a big misnomer. The only way you can teach design, in mine and many of my colleagues' views, is in a room, watching people's body language, how we can talk together, how we can actually learn from each other. Because, you know, I like teaching because I like to learn. So I'm learning from my guys who I'm working with all the time. And you just don't get that on various, I'm trying to not to say the Z word or the word, various platforms.
Yeah, yeah. And, I know exactly what you mean. What is the one piece of advice that you would give to people thinking of starting out on a career in interior design?
That you have to really want it. I think that all the experience and all the skills and that's all well and good, but I think that if you really want it enough, then you can do anything that you put your mind to.
Great. Leanne?
What a brilliant question. I would say, be passionate. Be passionate no matter what it is you do when you go into this. If, as long as you go in with the full understanding that this industry isn't going to make you a millionaire, you do this for the love of the job, for the experience you'll get out of it, the exposure, the people I've met around the world, the places I've been around the world that nobody talks about, that this industry has a way of taking you there, but also the different people, depends on what role you go into within that, you will learn so much just from that experience. And as long as you're open to that and don't come with an ego, I think that's probably the hardest part as a designer. You've got to remember that you're in this to help, to problem solve and to help get the best, in most instances, the most innovative or creative, but it needs to really deal with the problem it's set to solve.
Okay, Graham.
Two things. One is resilience. So there's going to be good days. There's going to be bad days. There's going to be times when you get knocked. There's going to be times when you're flying. And to learn from each of those opportunities, I think, is the greatest thing I can offer. But secondly, for me, it's all about sensibility. And what I mean by that is develop your own voice. Think about who you are as a designer, absorb everything, learn from it, and work out why you like it and critique it and understand why it's good, why it appeals to you, and what it makes you do, because that sensibility is your voice, and your voice is the thing of value, I think, in this or any industry or any discipline. And that's the thing that you need to develop. So your unique sensibility, your voice of how to be a designer, and that's fundamental.
And just one thing, actually, to wrap up with, it just occurred to me, Courtney, is there as a call to action, where can people go to find out more about an apprenticeship in interior design?
So the Institute for Apprenticeships and Technical Education has an interior designer apprenticeship page, which is being updated every time that there's an update. I've been posting regularly on my LinkedIn, so if people want to follow me or email me with any questions, I've had quite a lot of students at the moment email me saying, is this still going to be ready by the end of the year? And I've been like, I'll keep you updated. So yeah, there's also information about the apprenticeship on the BIID website, which is being updated as we go through the process.
Great stuff. And Graham, interior educator, so if I'm a person who wants to navigate the world of higher education on interior design, is there a central place that I can go to?
Yes, if you go to interioreducators.co.uk, that's a website which has all the details of 50 plus member programs across the UK. There's also some affiliate programs across the world, and you can see all of the details on those programs, how you might want to apply, and so on.
Great stuff. Great stuff.
Thank you so much, Courtney, Leanne, and Graham, for your time today. That's been the most fascinating conversation. I know I've got so much you've given me today. I need to go away and process and think about.
Yes, absolutely brilliant discussion. Thank you, everybody. And we do hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please do get in touch on our social channels at Interior Design Business Pod to share any feedback. The Interior Design Business is a Wildwood Plus production.